Are you tired of taking flack for your faith? Do you find that just because you're a Christian, you have an impossible situation with your family or your work? But what do? Don't give up. Stay tuned. Don't give up. God has a word of hope for you today.
Thanks for joining us for this Tuesday edition of Living on the Edge with Chip Ingram. Living on the Edge features the Bible teaching of Chip Ingram on this daily discipleship program. I'm Dave Drewy, and today Chip continues his series, Lift, the Awesome Power of Encouragement. Now in this program, he's going to show us four unique ways to help someone whose faith is under attack. Now if you don't get to hear all of today's message, remember, you can hear Chip's messages anytime on the Chip Ingram app. Now if you have a Bible handy, open it now to 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, and let's join Chip for his message, How to Lift Up Those Who Are Down.
I'll never forget the first day of Sociology 101. I was 18 years old. I had just become a Christian about 7 or 8 months before. I had never opened a Bible in my life until I was 18, and so I'd been reading it now about 6 or 7 months. I was overwhelmed with what I was learning. I had zeal. I was excited. The thought of forgiveness and peace and purpose. I was a zealous, brand new, whistling in the hall Christian. And then I went to sociology class. You got to remember, this is 1973. The 60s are rounding to an end. Kent State is barely in the rearview mirror for those of the era. I walk into class, and people are filing in, and I notice there's an unusual guy sitting on the desk up front. He has, for the day, extremely long hair, which was really unusual then. For a teacher at this school. He had frayed jeans, a rather unusual shirt, a headband, sandals, and he was sitting cross-legged on top of his desk. He was warm. He was friendly. He said nothing for the first 5 or 10 minutes. We all sat down, and he sat there bow-legged, crossed, looking at us, saying nothing. And then he began to open up, and we found out he was the teacher. Every textbook we studied, whatever you always thought or believed about life, about God, about America, about anything, he had a book to refute it. And he started for the next semester, week after week after week, to challenge every single thing that I believed. And I mean decimated the Christian faith. Now, I don't know the Bible very well. I don't know how to answer any hard questions. And at first I just thought, well, he's a little unusual. But he had a captive audience. And it wasn't long before he raised some doubts in my heart. And the confusion in my soul began to grow. And then I felt inadequate and I couldn't answer the questions. And I wasn't ready to give up my faith because I didn't want to become like this guy, but he was dealing with a lot of issues that I didn't know how to deal with. And I just felt knocked down. I just felt like he took the air out of my sails. He took the whistle off my lips. Whatever joy I was experiencing, I spent most of my time semi-confused and insecure and struggling and just feeling kind of beat down. His arguments weren't good enough or strong enough to really cause me to question the depths of my faith, but they were strong enough just to keep me messed up most of the time. And my observation is, it's only a matter of time before something or someone attacks your faith that will raise doubts in your heart, confusion in your soul, and a sense of inadequacy in your mind. In fact, you might have a work situation where there's such a culture of unbelief that basically day after day, it just assaults your faith and makes you feel lower or smaller because you're a believer. Or you might have an antagonistic family member. That works well. Someone that just, whatever you say, they have a little needle and their goal is to pop the balloon of your life whenever they get a chance. Or I've had a couple, quote, intellectual relatives. And you get together 3 or 4 times a year and they just keep asking these questions that at this point in your life, someone has good answers, but you don't. Or you have the fellow student or teammate that just, keeps looking at you. You really believe that stuff? Are you kidding? Don't both brain cells work with you? I mean, I don't get it. I thought you were a reasonable person. Or finally, there's the old friends who just question your newfound faith and say, how long is it going to last? How long are you going to go through this phase? And so the question I want to ask and answer tonight, as we're in the second part of a series on encouragement, is how do we encourage those people whose faith is being knocked down? How do you encourage the people that you know and that you rub shoulders with whose faith is called into question? They're constantly bombarded by criticism. They're ridiculed or attacked and maybe even persecuted on the job or in their family situation or on a sports team or school where they're at. How do you come alongside them when you see them wavering and faltering? What is it that God wants you to do as a fellow believer to encourage them, to lift them up, to help them work through their sociology 101 experience and come out the other end a stronger Christian? That's what we want to ask and answer today. And God has a game plan. And the game plan at first sounds really kind of weird. You know what the game plan is? Remember, remember, remember. The Bible is replete with the importance of remembering. In fact, in the Old Testament, the Bible will say, be careful lest you forget the Lord your God. Moses, when he took the second generation in, you know what he named the book? Deuteronomy, the second law. You know what the key word in the book of Deuteronomy is? Remember, 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 remember. Because you know what happened? The first group forgot. They forgot God's great acts, they forgot his great ways, and they didn't follow him. Now, the Apostle Paul, as we learned, went into a Greek town of about 200,000 people, Thessalonica, planted a church, it started to multiply, it started to grow, it started to mushroom, they were becoming well known, I mean, they were on fire and making incredible impact. And then some people came along and started slandering Paul, slandering their faith, poking fun. Just a little criticism. Oh, you know that Paul, yeah, we heard about him. He's just out for your money. Oh, that new Christianity stuff. Oh, man, it's dying out. Or we've heard this, we've heard that. And they kept poking and poking and poking. And so by the time Timothy came back to give the report, he said, Paul, they're really doing well, but man, they are taking it on the chin. Week in and week out, people are questioning your motives. They're questioning your message. They're questioning the validity of the Thessalonians' faith. And you know, I got to be honest with you, Paul, they're having a great impact, but you know they're going through some hard times. And so in chapter 2, verses 1 to 12, 1 Thessalonians, guess what Paul does? He causes them to remember the most important things in their life in order to restore their perspective so that they grow through their faith being knocked down. How do you help? How do you encourage people whose faith is being attacked or slandered? Now, I'd like to read through the passage, and as I read it, here's what I want you to do. I want you to pull out a pen. I'm going to put you to work. We're going to do a little Bible study. Whenever you read a passage of Scripture, words or phrases or concepts that are repeated are often the key to understanding the passage. Because if they're repeated once, twice, three times, they're important. If they're repeated five, six, seven times, they're probably the theme of what's being taught. So let's listen to what the Apostle Paul does. First, in verses 1 and 2, he reminds them of their reception of the message. He says, "For you yourselves know, brethren, that our coming to you was not in vain. But after we already suffered and been mistreated in Philippi, as you know, we had the boldness in our God to speak to you the gospel of God amid such opposition." You got your pen out? Put a little box around "you yourselves know" in verse 1 and then verse 2. Put a little box around "you know." First two verses, isn't it interesting that he's, "you know, you yourselves know." He's bringing things back to their memory. Notice in verses 3 through 6, he reminds them of the character of the messengers. He, Timothy, and Silas. He says, "For our exhortation does not come from error or impurity or by way of deceit, but just as we've been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak, not as pleasing men, but God who examines our hearts. For we never came with flattering speech, as you know." Guess what you're going to put a box around? "Nor with a pretext for greed. God is our witness. Nor did we seek glory from men, either from you or from others, even though, as apostles of Christ, we might have asserted our authority. Put a box around "as you know" in verse 5. Next, he reminds them of the ministry they received in verses 7 through 11. He goes, "But we prove to be gentle among you, as a nursing mother tenderly cares for her children. Having thus a fond affection for you, we were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel of God, but also our own lives." Why? Because you had become very dear to us. Verse 9, put a box around the next phrase. "For you recall, brethren, our labor and hardship, how working night and day, so as not to be a burden to any of you, we proclaim to you the gospel of God." Notice verse 10. "You are witnesses." What's that do? It reminds them. Put a box around that. "You are witnesses, and so is God, how devoutly and uprightly and blamelessly we behave toward you believers. Just as, verse 11, "you know how we were exhorting and encouraging and imploring each of you as a father would his own children." Why? Paul reminds them of the results in their lives when they receive the message. "So that," or resulting in, "that you may walk in a manner worthy of God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory." Now, just by way of doing a little Bible study, by the way, this is what I do. I'll read a passage over and over and over. And any concept that is repeated, then I'll circle it or underline it. Look at verse 1, "you yourselves know." Verse 2, "you know." Skip down to verse 5, "as you know." Skip down to verse 9, "for you recall." Verse 10, "you are witnesses." Verse 11, "you know." Are you getting the idea that possibly the Apostle Paul, writing to these people whose faith is being undermined, that he wants them to remember something? Could this be a possibility? Why? See, there's something extremely powerful about remembering. What we tend to do is see the problem on the horizon, and it doesn't have to be very big, but as that problem gets closer and closer and closer, what happens? We lose perspective, and we lose sight of all of this, let alone all that happened behind us. And one of the great ways to get perspective is to pull that problem back in light of history and what God has done and who He is and what you've experienced. Then all of a sudden, it's just a little pebble to deal with. But when you're looking at it right through here, it looks pretty big, doesn't it? And so the Apostle Paul is going to teach the Thessalonians, remembering God's work in the past is the key to getting perspective for doing His will in the present. That's what he's going to teach them. He's going to teach them, yeah, there's attack, there's slander, you lose perspective, but remembering God's work in your past is the key to getting perspective to do God's will in the present. And most of us don't do that much. And now what I'd like to do is I'd like to give you four key principles to help people who are faltering. Here's how to help them. First thing I think you need to do is help them remember the day. Just remember that phrase. Remember the day. You've got a friend, you've got a son, you've got a daughter, you've got a mom, you've got a dad, you've got a brother, you've got a sister, whoever it is, help them remember the day they came to Christ. Notice what Paul says in verse 1. "For you yourselves know, brethren, that our coming to you wasn't in vain." It means it wasn't empty. It's in a tense of the verb that means we came and something happened and the results are continuing in prosperity. He goes on in verse 2, "but after we had already suffered and been mistreated." He said, remember, we were in Philippi. Man, we got our heads bashed in. They took the clothes off our back. They threw us in prison. We were Roman citizens. We were publicly humiliated for doing what? For preaching the gospel. And yet, even though we went through that, you know that we had the boldness in our God. I like the NIV's translation. It says, "we dared to speak to you about the gospel of God amidst such opposition." Let me give you a couple things as you try and encourage people about remembering their day when they were saved. First, help them remember their experience. Now, we're in a day where people take experiences to an extreme, but sometimes in the church, we go the opposite direction. When's the last time you just sat down and really pondered your experience? Where you were in your life? What would have happened if you hadn't have trusted Christ? Think of all the things that have changed. Think of how little you knew, how much God must have loved you, where you were, what your life was like, the direction it was going, and boom, He came into your life. When's the last time you really thought about that? Well, guess what? The way God wants you to encourage other people, He wants you to remind them through a letter this week, or through a phone call, or through an invitation to lunch, or through an email. He wants you to do something to spur them on to remember the very day that they were saved. To reminisce, if you will. It will be a powerful experience, and it'll give them perspective. The second thing you might want to do to help others is help them remember the price tag and the sacrifice of those who shared it. You know, sometimes we look at our salvation experience just through our lens. The Apostle Paul, in stirring up their memory, you know, he does something. He makes sort of one of those left-handed compliments to himself, but he does it in such a way not to give him glory, but to encourage them. He says, you know, this stuff, preaching the gospel, it's not cheap and it's not easy. The last major town I did it in was Philippi. I got beat up. I got stripped publicly. I ended up in jail. And then I got run out of town. Now, thinking human beings realize that when that happens to you, keep your mouth shut next time. The Apostle Paul says, though, very interesting word. It has the idea of confidence and courage combined. And as you look at the translation, some of them translate the confidence and others the courage. We had boldness, or we dared to speak, even though there was a lot of opposition. What do you think the message is to the Thessalonians? You matter. Hey, you really matter. Last time we shared this message, we got beat up. When we came into town, we knew it was going to be a rough situation, and we dared to speak. We boldly proclaimed the message because that's how much you matter to God. When's the last time you thought of the price tag of the people who shared Christ with you? The bricklayer who was so instrumental in my life, I found out later that I remember the first Bible study I went to. It was on Thursday nights. Real down-home guy. He'd come with his moccasins, and he did have a nice guitar, Martin guitar. I didn't know anything about guitars. It was an old one. He could really pick it, too. Did a lot of bluegrass back then. And he'd wear his jeans, his moccasins, and he'd open up his living room, and he wanted to reach this campus for Christ. And the fullback on the football team invited me to go. And so I went, because he was the fullback on the football team. And he was big, and he was nice, and I thought, whatever he said, I should do right now. I didn't have any friends, didn't know anybody. And so I walked up this little road about a mile and a half, and I walked in Dave's house, and I didn't know what to expect. I mean, I don't know anything about this Christian stuff. I mean, I've been a Christian like 2 months, and there's four other people and me. Five of us. I'm thinking, this is a big meeting. And then I learned later that for 4 years, that's about how many people he had. Five people to eight people. Twice a week, he went down on campus and shared his faith. Every Thursday night for 3.5, 4 years, he opens up his home. He had decided this would be the last year. If God doesn't do something, then he's moving on. He moved to that little town to reach that campus. He was independently employed. He was a bricklayer. He could go wherever he wanted, and he traveled all over to do his trade. He wanted to reach that campus. He moved his family to that little town to reach that campus of about 4,000 or 5,000. Now, for whatever reason, that year it took off. That was my freshman year. By the time I was a junior, we dug out the basement underneath his house, and we had 250 kids in Bible study all over campus. And we saw a wave and a movement of God. But you know something? That guy hung in there for 4 years with five people a night on Thursday, and him giving two or three nights a week to tell kids about Christ that didn't seem to give a rip. But he kept telling, he kept going, he kept casting the seed. And I fortunately was, you know, kind of in that last installment. And I realized he paid a price. And when I think about that, I think, what an honor, God. That encourages me. The life lesson, you need to remember the day for yourself, for sure. That's not the life lesson. You need to remember the day for others. But here's the life lesson. Sow the seed wildly. Sow the seed of the gospel wildly. Past difficulty is not a prediction of future impact. We need to remember that. Jesus in his parable told us only 25% of the time people would respond well. Parable of the soils. Sow the seed wildly. Just every time, every opportunity, tell people. Tell them there's an answer for sin. There's forgiveness. It's Christ. He came. He loves them. He wants to give them peace. He wants to give them a new life. He wants to forgive them from the wrath, just wrath of God. Sow it wildly. That's what the Apostle Paul does. And then remember the day. Remember the day that you were saved. It will give perspective and encourage others. Whatever you can do to encourage them to remember the day they were saved. Second principle here is not only remember the day, but Paul says, remember the people. We need to remember the people that God used in our life, because when our faith is a little shaky, bringing back to mind those people and remembering their character and remembering later their love will help us get perspective. Notice what Paul says in verse 3. He says, for our exhortation or our appeal does not come from error, it means delusion, or impurity. There was no sexual connotations. Or by way of deceit. Now you say, why would he say sexual connotations? In that day, every Tom, Dick, and Harry was roaming around the Roman Empire, and they were doing their little tricks. And they did their little tricks either to hoodwink. They were charlatans, just like today. And they did it to get a following, to get self-promotion, to get money. And then most of the ancient religions had some sort of sexual deal hooked in with them. And the leaders were highly involved in it. And so the Apostle Paul, defending himself, he says, when we came, it wasn't no error, no impurity sexually, and no trickery or deceit. The word means literally a bait, like for a fish. He says, but just as we have been approved by God, notice this phrase, to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak. We've been approved by God. God's approval is on our life, and we have been entrusted. We are stewards of the gospel, so we speak. How? Not as pleasing people, but God, and he says, who examines our hearts. The character of the servants of the gospel message, he says, we were straight shooters. Notice verse 5. He says, for we never came with flattering speech. We would call it a con man. It's the idea of leading people along, getting them to follow you, building into their confidence until the point you take them down a different path, and the whole goal of the different path is you fleece them, either emotionally, monetarily, or sexually. He says, not us. We never came with flattery, as you know, nor with pretext, it's literally a mask, no hypocrisy. We didn't come for greed or money. He says, God's our witness. Nor did we seek glory from men. This wasn't about self-promotion or making a name or trying to be a somebody. Either from you or others, even though, by the way, let's get this straight, as apostles, we had every right to exercise some authority, but we didn't even do that. We gave away our apostolic rights in order to serve you. Here's his argument. They're being attacked, and they're going through their sociology 101 experience of faltering in the faith. And the Apostle Paul says, first of all, let's remember when you were saved. Remember that? Yeah. Second, he says, let's remember the character of the messengers. Remember me. Remember Timothy. Remember Silas. Remember how we lived. These attacks, these questions that are coming to your mind, they're unfounded. And so let me give you a couple ways underneath here to help people. First, help people remember the character of those who ministered to them. Help them think back of a person or two that they really admired, that were really straight shooters. They were people of integrity. Second, get them to compare the character and quality of those who ministered to them with the character and quality of those who are attacking them. That's critical. Did you get that? Get them to compare the character and the quality of those who've really genuinely helped them in their faith, and compare that with the character and the quality of those who are attacking. I'll still never forget the day. This sociology, I mean, he had me going up one day and down the next. And then he talked a little bit about his family, and I asked questions, and I saw his lifestyle, and I saw his morals, or I saw his lack of them. Then I saw his hypocrisy and his inconsistency. And what he was good at, it was a game people played in the 60s and late 70s. You know what people were really good at then? Cutting everything down and saying what was wrong with everything. But there weren't very many people who then stood up and said, and I'm willing to own the moral responsibility about how to make it right. All he did was cut down everything and everyone. And then as I watched him, you know what? He didn't even live by the same standards that he said. And I remember I was confused, and I stepped back one day and I thought, okay, there's a lot of questions and I can't handle all this. But I watched the way this bricklayer and his wife love each other and the kind of family they have. And when he says something, he means it, and he's faithful and he's loyal and he's true, and all he's done is love me. And I weigh that over against this professor who cuts down everything that I believe and who's cynical and sarcastic and his relationships aren't working. And he's hypocritical in what he says versus what he does. Now, which of those carry the most weight? Do you get it? See, that's what the Apostle Paul's doing. And we need to ask and help people who are discouraged, ask them whose life has the most credibility.
Chip will be back with his application for today's teaching. But if you're just joining us, you're listening to Living on the Edge with Chip Ingram. Chip's message, How to Lift Up Those Who Are Down, is from his series, Lift, The Awesome Power of Encouragement. Chip's teaching through the book of 1 Thessalonians, walking us through the different ways we can be an encouragement to others. Because the Apostle Paul knew that living the Christian life wasn't easy, he was teaching the Thessalonians how to help each other, hold one another accountable, and support each other. It's called Doing Life Together. This 6-part series not only helps you learn how to do that in ways that encourage others through trials like discouragement, hopelessness, or doubt, but it'll strengthen your walk with the Lord at the same time. Now, to help you get started, all the series resources for Lift are currently discounted. To check them out or to get your copies today, just head on over to livingontheedge.org or give us a call at 1-888-333-6003. Well, Chip, of all the areas where you see people needing encouragement, is there one particular that seems especially tough?
Absolutely, Dave. What I can tell you is marriage is hard. I mean, it is so difficult to keep that other-centered focus, to keep the communication and the intimacy and just really staying on the same page. And so we developed a tool that deeply encourages couples. They're called Marriage That Works cards. And what I did is I took like the top 20 lies that we believe about marriage. And so I wrote down the misbelief. And then on the back of the card, I wrote down the truth and I put a passage there. And I've had couples just individually or together, like just read over one card or read over a few cards, just keeping those things, the truth, in front of them. Because what happens is we get discouraged when we lose perspective. So the key to encouragement is having God's perspective. Let me give you an example here. Misbelief number 7 is marriage shouldn't be this difficult. No matter how hard I work, it seems like we always have issues to work through. I really wonder if it's worth it, right? We've all felt that way. Then you flip the card over and here's the truth. Everything of great value requires commitment, sacrifice, and perseverance. As my spouse and I face challenges and overcome them, our intimacy and joy will far outweigh our present problems. If you know someone, not just are they struggling, but, you know, maybe it's your son or daughter or one of the guys you play golf with or, you know, one of the ladies in the Bible study, and you just think, I really want to encourage her or him. What a powerful thing to jot a quick note and say, wow, when I think about God's design for marriage and I review these cards, it makes a difference. And you pass on these cards to them. And what I will guarantee, it will give them a lift. It'll give them God's perspective. It'll give them encouragement in the most important relationship in their life.
Thanks, Chip. Well, not only do we have these great Marriage That Works cards, but during this series, we've discounted all of our truth card sets because we want to put the perfect tool in your hands to either encourage you personally or to help you encourage someone you know. Now, we have truth cards on affirmation for women struggling with self-image or self-worth, biblical living from the Gospel of John, and our latest set, Discuss This, designed to help parents and grandparents engage with their kids in meaningful conversation about faith issues and Christian values. So let me encourage you, yes, that's right, let me encourage you to take advantage of the current discounts on our Truth Card packets. For all the details and to order your sets today, just go to our website, livingontheedge.org, or give us a call at 1-888-333-6003. Well, now here's Chip with a final thought.
Do you know someone who is really going through a hard time right now because of their faith? I want you to ask God to bring to mind, is there someone who's being criticized or bombarded? Someone who's ridiculed, maybe by their family or at work? I mean, someone who's maybe even persecuted. I mean, they are about ready to give up the faith, or it's a constant struggle. Does anyone come to your mind like that? See, that was the situation that the Thessalonians found themselves in. And Paul wrote this letter to say, I want to help you. I want to encourage you. And the theme of his letter was, remember, remember, remember. And so as this person comes to your mind, I want to give you a little game plan to help them. Remember, a word of encouragement can transform a person's life. Your time with them, helping them remember, can make all the difference in the world. But you say, well, what is it that they need to remember? There's going to be four things. I want to give you two of them today. The first thing is they need to remember the actual day that they came to Christ. They need to ponder and think about when was the day, what happened, where were they, what was their life before? Because see, what this will do is give them perspective. And that sounds so trite. Most people won't do that, and they won't do it well. But let me give you a little clue. Here's what you do. You know this person, they've come to your mind, God's brought them to your mind, you give them a call, send them an email and say, hey, can we do kind of lunch next week or breakfast, or can we just grab a cup of coffee or take a walk? And you don't make a big deal, you don't act like it's some big meeting, but you know their situation. And when you get with them, you say, Bob, Mary, whatever their name, would you tell me how you came to know Christ? And they might say, well gosh, you know, no, I want the long version. I really want to hear it. And ask questions and get them to rehearse and think back. What was their life like before they became a Christian? How forgiven, how loved, and the transformation that's occurred. And what that will do is give perspective. That's what Paul did here. The second thing you need to do is help them remember the people God used in their life. Isn't that what Paul did right out of this passage? You see, you got away these people that are attacking you and these people that have loved you. And you have to say to yourself, I'm getting a lot of flack, but in the end, who do I want to be like? And you can be the friend that just helps them rehearse it and say, tell me who led you to Christ. What was attractive about their life? What was it about their marriage? Or how was it that they lived in their singleness? What was it, the winsome quality? And you ask them, and you get them talking, and you know what'll happen? Someone's going to get encouraged, and the Holy Spirit of God will use you to do it. What a deal, huh? Go do it.
As we wrap up today's broadcast, just a quick but important thought. Living on the Edge depends on friends like you to provide the necessary funding to continue broadcasting right here in your area. Would you prayerfully consider partnering with us on a monthly basis so people in your area can continue to benefit from the ministry of Chip and Living on the Edge? Now, to set up a recurring donation, call us at 1-888-333-6003. Or if you prefer to give online, you can donate securely at livingontheedge.org. And thank you in advance for doing whatever God leads you to do. Well, tomorrow Chip continues his series, Lift, the Awesome Power of Encouragement. So I hope you'll make plans to join us then. For all of us here, this is Dave Druey saying thanks for listening to this edition of Living on the Edge.